listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Let's start off in the solar system, but something that's going to happen in a few months. There's a launch in, I think it's planned for October, the Europa Clipper mission, which is a NASA mission to Jupiter's icy moon Europa. The mission is searching for or looking at chances of finding life on the moon. I don't think it's going to directly search for life, but to be able to investigate the moon in more detail and see what's happening with the icy crust and the liquid water ocean underneath and all this kind of stuff. But it's had one element of it that's nothing to do with the science, but inspired by missions from the 1970s, so the Voyager missions, which took their plaques and their golden records out into interstellar space. So Europa Clipper is not going that far. It's only, I say only, it's still quite a long way. It's only going to Europa in orbit around Jupiter. But it's it is going to take a message, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it's so this is at the assembly stage right now, which is why this is in the news. They're assembling the spacecraft, even though it's going to be launched in 6 months, and then it's going to be orbiting Jupiter in 2030. So this is obviously it's a long-term thing. The plaque, like you said, Chris, is following in the footsteps of Voyager and also Pioneer, which I think was the first spacecraft that had a plaque with the famous Adam and Eve picture. This one's a little bit different. It's got language represented there once again, but not in the form of a record with instructions that you have to work out and decipher to play it, but waveforms of the word water, because it's one of the principal things that Europa Clipper is going to investigate. Scientists are almost 100% sure that there is water underneath an icy surface of Europa, and that's why the mission's going there. So it's got water in a lot of different languages, including American Sign Language. You might wonder how you can have a picture of American Sign Language and not a video, but they've got some sort of representation of that as well. And on the back, there's a poem by the US poet laureate, Ada Limon. And there's also, I think, 2.6 million names as well, which seems like that would be an awful lot of information to carry around. I hope they've signed the GDPR away on having their personal details sent out into outer space. It's the US, so it probably doesn't count.
It's probably not, no.
Probably doesn't go through the European Union at any point. But they're electron engraved on a microchip, so very, very small. So this is a little bit of a PR stunt just to make it a little bit more relevant or a little bit of attention grabbing. But I really like these plaques. Mm. You know, they're much better than like the lunar commemorative plaque, which is just, you know, something that just gets fixed onto a spacecraft that nobody really knows about, that has the date and the time on it of, and you know, who was on the mission. I really do like the idea that that there's some useful, more less introspective, less looking towards the Earth and more looking out towards the cosmos, that sort of global perspective that
I think
astronauts often talk about.
The interesting thing, so the Voyager plaques that they had was that they? The idea was that this could be a message towards, you know, an alien race who might find Voyager in, you know, however many million years that it encounters another thing. This feels much more it's for us, it's for humanity to commemorate it. You know, we don't think there's, you know, life forms on Europa. We don't think, I mean, we may be wrong, but we don't think there's like, you know, European whales swimming around in the ocean or anything like that. If it's anything there, it's microbial, and they probably can't access a silicon chip. This is for us to commemorate, as you say, and that's to mark it. And we've seen that before with some of the Mars rovers have had little plaques and pictures and that kind of thing on it, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, and building that sort of community, that sort of investment in something that's so expensive is actually a really sensible idea because people feel like part of them has contributed to this mission. And that's something that the European Space Agency did with the Rosetta mission a little bit with the Wake Up Rosetta. They were inviting people to take selfies of when they had to wake up Rosetta, where Rosetta went into sort of hibernation when it went out into deep space. And it was a real chance of Rosetta not waking up. But instead of like hiding, the ESA really took the bull by the horns and really got everybody involved. If it had failed, it would have been spectacular failure, but it didn't. And a lot of people felt like they were part of the wake up process.
As long as I don't blame it on the people who were trying to wake it up and tell them they should have shouted louder. That's So that's a nice little thing that's going to go to Jupiter, well, launch later this year and spend about 6 years traveling there, to then go and investigate that exciting moon and search for potentially search for signs of life. We shall see. Okay, let's move outwards. We're going to go out to a white dwarf star that is been observed by the Very Large Telescopes. It's a telescope down in Chile from the European Southern Observatory. So one of the largest telescopes in the world, with some really, really advanced instrumentation on board, and they've been studying this white dwarf, which we know spin, we know generally have fairly strong magnetic fields, and they've found something really interesting when they stare at it and they look at the signature of the elements that make it up. There's some elements that aren't uniformly distributed around this star. As it rotates, they change. I mean, I think this must have been a bit of a conundrum, but there's a theory behind why this is, isn't it? It's due to, well, they call it cannibalism, but it's absorbed something.
Yes, the it's not unheard of for white dwarfs to be hungry after they've had a big explosion. A white dwarf is what's left when a star that's quite similar to our sun reaches the end of its life, and it can't hold on to the outer layers as it starts transitioning from burning hydrogen in the core to burning helium and other larger elements. They don't give out as much energy, and so it can't hold on to its outer layers, and they gradually drift away, just exposing this very hot core. And the very, very hot core we call a white dwarf, but it had previously been the center of a star. And it doesn't have any thermonuclear processes going on. It's very hot and white, and it gradually cools as the universe ages. But if there's stuff left in the solar system that it was around, it can get a little bit greedy and start gobbling away at these things. And what we're seeing with this discovery is something that has been eaten and left a scar, which is quite unusual to see. Something that hasn't been shredded and just consumed, but is still well defined. And it seems to be that it's a mixture of rotation and magnetic field that has resulted in this scar, which is metals that are on the surface of the star.
And they reckon that it's something that was about the size of Vesta. So that's the second largest object in the asteroid belt, about 500 kilometers across. So a fairly beefy thing. That's the size of a, well, that's the roughly the diameter of the United Kingdom, right? It's sorry, the width of the United Kingdom. So it's a fairly big object. You wouldn't want it landing on you. But it's metal rich. It's got lots of rock and iron and so on in it. And yeah, that's what's then fallen, as you say, in one or a few chunks, rather than been ripped apart and gradually distributed over the star, which is interesting. It does make you think. I mean, our sun, when it comes to the end of its life, is going to, in about 5 billion years. So don't change your insurance policies. But in about 5 billion years, it's going to expand to the diameter. Its diameter will be about roughly the diameter of the Earth's orbit, probably a little bit less. But that means that it will have consumed Mercury and Venus. Or they will have ended up in the envelope of the star, and I think there's some uncertainty about exactly what happens in that situation because the star, the material in the star, although it's very hot, it's not actually that dense. It's not necessarily that those planets will, you know, melt. They might end up as objects still kind of within that star, spiraling inwards maybe. And when those outer layers get shed off, and the very core, which is about the size of the Earth, right in the center, there might be some remnant of those planets still left orbiting that then slowly spirals inwards. So, an interesting discovery of what might happen in the long distant future of our sun, but also a technological marvel to be able to do this with a star that is the size of the Earth. So it's much smaller than most stars we look at, and to be able to do this at this kind of distance and this resolution.
Yeah, it's the VLT is one of the most unoriginally named telescopes ever, the Very Large Telescope. But it is very large. And so that's, you know, really what you need. It also has it has something called adaptive optics as part of it. And so it can really get very high precision, even though it's on the ground in the on the Earth and seeing through the Earth's atmosphere.
And one of the instruments that they use for this, which is called FORS 2, it can measure the polarization of the light. And that means it's something you might see in sort of polarized sunglasses, where we use it to cut down on reflections and so on from the road or water or snow or whatever. But that can also give you a sign as to magnetic fields, because certain materials will get, certain particles and so on will get oriented in the magnetic field in particular ways. And then we can use this polarization to see which way they're oriented. So several ways of doing this in very great detail. Let's stick with stars, but let's go with a few more stars rather than just one old star. Let's go with also old stars detected or measured and identified by the Gaia satellites. The Gaia satellite is a European Space Agency satellite that's been up in space for 11 years now. It's crazy to think it's 11 years, launched at the end of 2013. Its mission is not to take pretty pictures, but to really, really, really carefully measure the position of stars in our galaxy. And I think it's measuring the positions of, you know, a billion stars or that kind of order, which is pretty impressive goal. But not just the positions, also the velocities and the speeds. And that's let them, if you kind of figure out how stars are moving and then try and rewind the clock to see, well, if they're moving that at this position and these speeds now, can you say, well, actually these stars were originally in the same place at some point or another? And so they end up with these streams of stars that have been slowly spreading out in the galaxy but did come from the same place. And they found two new ones.
Yeah, and it's worth saying that although a billion stars sounds like a lot of stars, it's about 1% of all the bodies in the Milky Way. So although a billion sounds like a large number, doing a study really, you have to put it in those terms that what you're looking at is 1% of the objects. And this will be because these other objects are either obscured or they're just too faint. So this study has discovered two classes of stars that are quite old. They're stars that are about 12, 13 billion years old. So these were stars around very soon after the Big Bang. They're very different to our sun. And they won't have the same sort of metals in them, and they'll probably be very large as well. They're concentrated towards the center of the Milky Way, but they're sort of in a ball-like halo. Mm-hmm. Unlike a lot of the stars that we see, which are in the disk of the Milky Way. It's really interesting to see that there are two distinct populations or two distinct groups of stars that are very old, and it could tell us something about how the Milky Way formed and became a spiral galaxy.
Well, it's thought that some these populations were two of the earliest, not necessarily the two earliest, but two of the earliest sort of streams of stars that would have collected together and formed what is now the core of the Milky Way that everything else grew from. A galaxy has got to grow from somewhere, probably from sort of streams of gas, dust, and these first stars merging together and spiraling in. And then over time, other stuff has come in and formed the other materials that form the spiral arms and so on. So this is fascinating that by studying these stars, we could be looking back at the very, very early universe. They're probably relatively low mass stars because they have to have lived for 12 to 13 billion years. If they were much higher mass, they'd have probably died, exploded or whatever a long time ago. And I think it's by looking at their chemical composition and going, these look different to kind of your common or garden star that is existing in the Milky Way, that we can figure that these are different in some way. So as well as just doing that, how far away are they and how fast they're moving, Gaia is also able to say, what are they made of? So it's a third string to that. To that bow. So they've been given names, haven't they? So Shakti and Shiva. So that's stars that formed billions of years ago. But we also see stars forming today. We see stars forming in interstellar dust clouds and gas clouds in our galaxy. And one of the telescopes, one of the instruments that's looking at that is, of course, JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, which is observing stars forming in our galaxy, and it's able to look at the composition of these things, it's found these gas clouds contain a couple of things that we kind of knew were there, but studying them is always nice. So one is ices, so water ice, but also methane ice and various ethanol. Other ices, yeah, ethanol, and then there is those complex organic molecules, ethanol and acetaldehyde. I'm not a chemist, so you have to forgive me. Acetaldehyde, I think. Yeah. Those kind of things. So, but studying these elements and how they're forming is telling us a little bit about the process going on in that star forming region.
Stars form from big clouds of gas and dust. And what we're seeing here, like you said, Chris, are these complex organic molecules. And those are not really the type of thing that you need for stars. You need pure hydrogen is the best thing for a star, and a lot of it. But for planets, you really need other things other than hydrogen, particularly if you're looking for life. We think that what we know about how life forms is based on one planet, which has rocks, lots of organic molecules, water, and so these type of things are very important for life. What we're seeing with this study is that dust is also extremely important because the chemical reactions that are happening on the surface of dust grains. For a long time, people have known that dust grains are actually important for catalysis, for the catalysts for a lot of reactions in the interstellar medium, because the clouds of cosmic dust and gas are very cold. And if you've ever done an experiment in chemistry, you'll normally have to add some heat into it if you don't have a catalyst. And so dust grains are actually extremely useful for providing this catalyst.
It also gets things in the same place, right? Because one of the challenges, yep, with a very diffuse cloud of gas and dust is that this stuff is very spread out. It's not very dense at all. Whereas on a dust grain, you then have two molecules of, ethanol and acetaldehyde, methyl formate or whatever, acetic acid, all those kind of things, close to each other on the dust grain that can then, then can react in some way.
Yeah, and if it's a question of getting across bonds and breaking bonds, that's unlikely to happen. But if it's about sharing electrons, then that type of thing could happen. Much, much longer than it would happen in a lab, but it could still it can still happen. And yeah, you're right, Chris, on the surface of dust grain is the match.com of the interstellar medium.
And so we have these dust grains or these ices, and as you say, these are the catalyst for having some complex processes going on. I mean, we have seen evidence in our solar system of really complex molecules in meteorites and so on. It's not quite clear whether they've formed out in deep space or whether they've formed in some other way, come from a planet or something. But we do see very complex complex molecules. But yes, studying these in the ice phase of these star formations is a new one. One thing we do have to do, though, is talk about where the dust itself comes from. So the dust is normally tiny, tiny grains of carbon-rich and silicon-rich minerals. Those are carbon and silicon are fairly common things that come out of stars. But there's long been a question about where all that comes from. And there are various theories of it could come from old stars, dying stars, it could come from exploding stars. But a couple of months ago, there was a study published regarding the origin of dust. And to find out more about that study, I spoke to Professor Hayley Gomez and Dr. Cosimo Insero, both based here at Cardiff University. And I thought an interesting thing was to start by, given that this is the origins of stuff that then forms planets, and then in the end, you know, the stuff on that planet, including life, I thought I'd start by asking Hayley the possibly mean question of where do we come from?
That's a very deep question. Well, we've known for a long time that we're all made of stardust, okay? Everybody has heard that lyric or that quote. And the question is where exactly or what kind of stars make that dust and when they make that dust. So is it the first stars in the universe that evolve very quickly, or is it stars that kind of take billions of years to evolve? And so one of the things we've realized in the last few years, or probably actually about the last decade, is that the explosion of stars can produce a lot of dust in the universe and kind of pollute galaxies with all of the material that we need to help the next generation of stars form, but to also form the building blocks of rocky planets and even life itself. And so it's quite interesting to realize that these very titanic, violent explosions are actually responsible for polluting the galaxies with an awful lot of material that we need to build planets like the Earth. This case, though, is a surprise because we hadn't actually known that an explosion of this kind of star would form dust. And in fact, all of the research that people across the world, and myself included, had suggested that they didn't create dust. So it was really interesting seeing this example because it was a whole new opening of a channel of how we can form dust in galaxies that we'd never really considered properly in any way. So yes.
And on you mentioned there explosions of this type of exploding star, Cosimo. We actually in astronomy we see stars explode all the time. In fact, event name, the three letters at the end tell us sort of when in the year and how many other events that have been like that in 2018 by the time this was discovered. And I think that there's a lot of them. There are a lot of supernovas, so exploding stars, appearing in the sky in 2018. What's special about this particular event?
So that's right, Chris. We identify more than 20,000 exploding stars per year, and they are more than 100 times this amount every year. So what was different about this one is that when we took an electromagnetic spectrum of these objects, electromagnetic spectrum is like something like looking at the electrocardiogram of the star. It tells us the specific electricity, specific chemical elements that are present in the stars, which tell us the fingerprints of the original star that exploded. So the curious thing is that there were some elements that shouldn't not be there for this kind of events, which comes usually from a binary star, so which one of the two is a white dwarf, which is already evolved star that if left alone, it would have died by the end of the cosmos, it would still be the same. So it could not explode as a supernova unless it is disturbed by a companion star. Nevertheless, when we see them, we know how they are. We know perfectly how they are, as the one that has been used in cosmology to prove the evolution of the cosmos. But this one was particular because there were these additional lines of hydrogen. They should not be there. And so that told us that was interesting per se. And we could have seen much more of these of the evolution that led to this kind of explosion. And is why we started to follow it up with our set of telescopes.
And so you mentioned this binary star with this white dwarf star. You mentioned it's already an evolved star. This is the dead core of a star that probably wasn't vastly unlike our sun when it was in the main part of its life. Haley, that particular object has already undergone one kind of transition into its current state. So that transition from a main sequence star like our sun to this white dwarf, this dead core, has that helped produce any of the elements that we're made from?
Well, actually, it's the thing that we think is going on here is that it's the interaction of the explosion with the material that surrounds it. So there could be some mass loss by the star before it becomes a white dwarf. There you might have some metals, some heavy elements that might go into the surrounding medium. But the dust itself is not, very little dust would be created in that. The winds are very thin and they don't particularly have the right conditions for dust formation. But what we do know is that after the explosion, we saw the signature of dust growing. So the dust itself was not there before the explosion, hit the surrounding gas. But with that explosion, when that happened, the glow from the dust got brighter and brighter over time. So it's that interaction that's happened. And this is the reason why we didn't think these stars and these explosions would actually form dust, because on their own they shouldn't. But with the interaction of the interstellar or the circumstellar medium, the gas around it, you've got this freshly baked dust that is just created from that interaction. And it's completely changed the way that we view that interaction, because that will happen in other supernova systems as well. For example, the explosion of massive stars into its own mass loss. So yeah, it's a nice little kind of combination of the effects. You've got the binary system, you've got the supernova explosion, and you've got the material that's cast off. Now, we don't know if the material that it's expanded into was actually from the pre-white dwarf star or from the companion, but those two things together were needed to be able to make it, with the explosion and the mass loss that happened before.
And Cosmo, so you mentioned this is a binary star. We know it's got this dust around it. Now, in the movies, you zoom in and you see these two things orbiting around each other in incredibly high detail. In reality, we're looking at a pinprick of light in an image. I mean, we're not resolving this. We're not seeing this. We're not seeing two objects going around each other here. I mean, this thing is a very, very long way away, kind of by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, maybe cosmologists think it's nearby, but really, this thing's a long way away. How do we figure out what's going on from the observations?
So basically, yes, we only see a glimpse of light for any kind of supernova. We cannot resolve the system. So we never know a priori what's going on. So what we do, there are a lot of surveys in our planet that look at the night sky every night. A lot of them, they also do that multiple times over the night in the same portion of sky. And basically what we do is playing a cosmic games of spots the differences between the two images. And then if in the second one we finally see something new, that is most likely a supernova, or it might be a satellite, or it might be an asteroid. So we know about satellites' trail. We know about asteroids that have been monitored for a long time. So if we exclude the two of them, we know it's a supernova. And then by how the luminosity of these new source changes, we have some means of what kind of supernova might be, what kind of stellar explosion might be. And then is when we enter in the game and we start to get these kind of electromagnetic fingerprints to understanding their chemical evolution. Only combining these two information, you can actually understand that is a true supernova, is true stellar explosion, and what kind of stars actually was before. Like this binary system has critical signatures of iron production. So it produces a lot of iron elements and iron peak elements like silicon or sulfur. And that usually massive stars alone do not produce. Those, they usually produce hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. So when you see these, you know what's going on, basically.
So we know that this explosion is and the interaction has produced these very heavy elements. Hayley, you mentioned that this is something that would happen because of this kind of this I guess perfect storm of having the exploding star, the binary companion, the stuff going around it, this shock wave passing through all that material to generate the dust that we're seeing. I guess two questions that maybe are linked. One is how have you seen this dust? How have we seen the dust in these observations? And the second is how you mentioned this might happen in other systems. How easy is it just to go and find some other systems where this might be happening?
With the first question, there's actually quite a few signs that the dust was formed in this interaction. The first one is that dust basically acts as a smokescreen. So you have, if you have dust in front of something bright and shiny, then it will make the bright shiny thing look like it's fainter or dimmer. And so what we first saw is, as we followed this with all of the different telescopes that Cosimo talked about, the ones that could work in the same ways that our eyes work, the visible light telescopes or optical telescopes, we started to see the supernova get fainter over time. And that's a sign that something is going on that is maybe reducing the light or making it look fainter than it should be. The other thing that we saw was that if we use an infrared telescope, so slightly longer wavelengths of light, we look at the infrared glow, we know that's from dust emission. And what we saw was at the same time as you saw the visible light declining, you saw the infrared light increasing and getting brighter. And what that tells you is that first of all, you need the dust to be in the supernova itself. If it was behind the supernova and in front of the supernova, it wouldn't have quite the same characteristic signal that we see. But it also shows you that the dust growth is, in this case, the dust growth is really quite rapid. So I think the numbers that we talk about are, you know, after only 1,000 days, we've got about 1% of the mass of the sun in terms of how much dust is formed. Now, if that dust survives and it stays or continues to grow even, it's the most efficient dust production source that we've seen, because even other types of explosions have not created this much dust so quickly. And not only that, but we know that we've got to put it into perspective here, because these supernovae are actually quite rare, these interactions from a type 1A supernovae and the circumstellar medium is just quite a rare process. But the point is it's a new way to form dust, and that's why it's an interesting way. In terms of the second question, how do we go out and find these things? Well, we have seen them in a type of supernova called a core collapse or a type 2. So these are massive stars, single massive stars that explode at the end of their lives. And we've seen in some cases, for example, the Cassiopeia A supernova remnant, we've seen that explosion, and actually in this case it is resolved. We've seen that explosion, all the ejecta from the star moves outwards and interacts with the material around it. So we have seen that process before in a massive star, single supernova, but we didn't think it would be the same thing as what we would see in a type 1A. Mm. So we do know these things exist, and we can look at nearby supernovae to get an idea of how it happens, but they're not the 1As. We haven't resolved the dust emission in a 1A. We can just look for the signatures in both the visible and infrared light.
And so then what we need is Cosimo, you're involved with teams and you lead some teams that go and search for these supernovae, things that go and flash in the night. Is it a case that what you can provide to Hayley and colleagues who are looking at the dust signature of these things is, here's a short list of things that are good candidates? Is that something that you think you're close to being able to do, to say this thing looks interesting for these reasons, go check it out?
We are actually currently already doing that. We've been doing that for the last 10 to 12 years.
Okay.
The problem is that these good candidates are rare. So you need a good candidate at the right distance. And that's the trick. This one was one of the few that was a very strong interaction, and it was also very nearby.
And so when we say nearby, we're talking 300 million light years, which, as we said earlier, is a long way, but actually that's relatively close for people looking at some of these things.
You have to think that this kind of supernova has been the closest one in the last 13 years. Wow. I think the other closest one was one that was called another catching and appealing name. It was PTF 11KX.
It says something that you got the name of that thing ingrained in your memory. So
I think it was this one.
Yeah, we'll check it out later. So you can get this shortlist and put them forward. I mean, this is the closest one for 13 years. I mean, the other event that is topical at the moment because of new results that come out is the closest supernova we know of in modern times, at least, which is supernova 1987A, which is a slightly catchier name. An exploding star that went off in 1987, from our point of view, in a very, very local galaxy, a large magellanic cloud. So rather than being 300 million light years away, it's, 160,000 light years away? So it's... what's that, 2,000 times closer? I mean, Hayley, you've been involved in studying some of that. Does that shed any light on any of this? Or is it just, is there not this sort of companion nature to that explosion?
Yeah, that's right. So this is a single star, a massive star, probably about 20 times the mass of our sun when it was born. And so we've seen it, we saw it explode in 87. We've followed it since. And in fact, some recent news from the James Webb Space Telescope has really revealed some really cool things about not just the dust within this remnant, within this this explosion, but also things about the actual stellar core that people have been looking for ages. Scientists have been trying to understand whether there is a stellar core left behind a neutron star, and nobody really has seen it before. And in 2019, we argued quite controversially at the time that what we could see in the glowing dust that we could see at the center of this supernova remnant was actually a neutron star enshrouded by dust, and the neutron star was heating the dust up when we could see it. So yes, lots of dust formed and kind of blocking out this stellar core that we expect to see after this kind of explosion, but nobody had ever detected. And that was a little bit of a kind of, well, we think we've seen this, but now we have direct evidence. Actually, in the past few days, JWST, the James Webb Telescope, has actually detected the fingerprints that Cosmo was talking about earlier, fingerprints from the neutron star, that stellar core. And so we know that for sure there's a neutron star there, which totally what we predict, but has never been seen before. And it's enshrouded in this cloud of dust that was freshly formed after the star exploded. There we don't have any interaction with anything else, so the dust is just from the stuff that was in the star and after the explosion dust formed. And really that's kind of what we see in these massive star supernovae. The dust is just forming in the ejecta, but what we don't know is what will happen over time, because very soon it's going to hit a different shock wave, and whether that will then, you know, just kind of cause the dust to be destroyed or evaporate it or whatever. It's a different thing. So it's a very different situation to the one we've got with supernova 2018 EDT. Mm. But it does give us that insight that we have that kind of resolved view because it's so close. Mm. In both cases, we want to have James Webb, you know, monitoring these things over time to follow what happens to the dust. Does it survive? That's the big question.
So one final question each on the on the future of this. So Cosmo, we've been tracking supernova 1987A for 27 years now, by my count. Are we going to be tracking 2018 EVT in 27 years' time, do you think?
It is difficult, but not completely impossible, for one reason. It's completely different from 87A. A lot of these supernovae that have interacting, they interact with these circumstellar material. They have these very long-lasting signature of interaction with this material. However, all of these, they usually we've seen something like these before, even these PTF-11 kegs. They after 3 to 4 years, they got much, much dimmer than before because this interaction ends. So this additional source of luminosity, which is allowing us to observe at that distance, just disappear overnight. And basically in a month, they become 100 times dimmer than before. Mm. And they are beyond our current telescope capability. So it's not impossible, but it's very, very difficult. And just because of the system.
You said that's after 3 or 4 years, so we're now 6 years on. So are we waiting for that to happen, for this thing just to disappear from our point
of view? This one has already disappeared in the optical, so we can only see in the near infrared because of the dust.
Okay. It's, I guess, a law of decreasing returns as it gets fainter and fainter and fainter. Hayley, one final one for you. So you mentioned at the start that we don't quite know where all this dust that we're, this stardust that we're made of, how to sort of budget for all that, where's that all come from in the universe. You also said that this is the most efficient way we've seen so far, or one of the most efficient ways of creating dust in the universe. You also said there aren't many of these things that we see out there. Can we put a handle on whether this completes the picture, or potentially completes the picture of this, or are we still looking for more sources of dust out there to explain where we come from, essentially?
So it's not going to solve the problem. It's just too rare, and we do need to find another source of dust. Where that source is, it's got to be stars of some kind at some point in their life, but right now we don't know.
Okay, so lots more to look at in the future to find other sources. So. Lots more interesting things for Cosmo to go and find, and Hayley to study in more detail, and of course all your collaborators around the world as well. Cosmo, Hayley, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
That's it for this month. Thanks to Edward, Hayley, and Cosmo for joining us. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. You can also find us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.